You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Sympathy for the Devil by Julie Miller. After Palm had Noelle in 1977 and her son Mills in 1979, she became a devoted stay-at-home mother who relished arts and crafts activities with her kids and making clothing for them. She volunteered for the Junior League and fostered her faith. The night before her kidnapping, Palm read about Corrie Ten Boom, a Holocaust survivor and activist who found healing in forgiving a Nazi guard stationed at the concentration camp where her sister was killed. Loving someone who loves you is easy, Palm knew. The true challenge was loving someone who hates you. On the morning of December 11th, before she encountered the serial killer who would change her life, she knelt in her closet and told God she would serve him however he needed her to that day. Growing up, Morin dreamed of becoming a stock car racer, but as a teenager, the only racing he did was from the cops. He was born in Providence and spent his teen years in Florida. After a stay in a juvenile detention home and multiple car thefts, he was briefly placed in the state-run Florida School for Boys in Marianna. The reform school was notorious for its horrific conditions, understaffed and overcrowded facilities, boys being chained to walls, beatings, abuse, and in some instances, death. In 2013, anthropologists discovered 55 graves on and around the property. At age 14, Morin made headlines for his escape from the school. After stealing a car from his father, who was visiting, Morin ended up wrecking three vehicles before he was caught. He was taken to a hospital with injuries, escaped the hospital, led the local sheriff's department on a 100-mile-per-hour car chase, and was caught again. That same year, having already stolen more than 20 cars in his short life, how was I to know he'd use the lessons I taught him to steal, his mechanic father once told the press. Morin was tried as an adult and sentenced to time in Florida State Prison, the same institution in which Bundy lived, before his execution 2 decades later. Morin blamed his criminal perversions on his mother, sending him to a boys' home. His witnessing of his mother's alleged sexual abuse of his brother and her supposed sexual exploits with a friend his age, as well as being sent as a 15-year-old to prison, where Morin claimed he was sodomized. He habitually blamed others for his crimes, including a woman he murdered for making him do it. As a teenager, Morin once sent his parents a letter that read like a cry for help. "Boy, I'm sick, not the kind of sick you need a doctor for." His parents later shared the letter with a reporter, along with a scrapbook containing write-ups of Morin's crimes. Next photos, change of heart, with her husband Bart, and Noelle and Mills on Christmas after the abduction. Morin and a letter he sent before his first murder trial. After being paroled, Morin became an even more prolific criminal. His offenses included possession of various drugs, hitting a girlfriend, and killing the girlfriend's Siamese cat, Sweetie, then delivering Sweetie's body in a box to his girlfriend's office. In 1976, after marrying his first wife, Morin was said to have committed a crime so disturbing that a lawyer who worked one of his trials is still haunted by it. Morin lured his sister's 14-year-old friend back to his apartment under the pretense that his sister needed her help. Once there, Morin gagged the teen and sexually tortured her for 6 hours while the TV blared. The experience was so horrific, the survivor tells me nearly 50 years later, that she found herself wondering if she could get the momentum to swing herself through the second-floor window to a more humane death. The 14-year-old eventually appealed to Morin with softness. After Morin removed her gag, she told him, "You just need somebody to care about you. You're just hurt." The woman explains, "I think that's why he let me live, because I showed him compassion." Before fleeing town, Morin allowed her to leave, with bruises covering her body and face, as well as trauma that manifested throughout her life via low self-esteem and drug addiction. The women Morin attacked afterward were not so lucky. With a warrant out for his arrest in San Francisco and an FBI file now devoted to him, Morin moved on to Las Vegas. There, he assumed new aliases, got a new job and wife, and leaned into murder. His modus operandi was to hunt attractive white women, mostly in their teens and twenties, tie them up, torture and kill them, then steal their cars, IDs, and assorted possessions. By the time authorities found his victims, discarded in deserts, shallow graves, and fleabag motels, Morin would be hunting a new woman in a new location using a new alias. Even as Morin and his second wife celebrated the birth of their son, he is said to have kidnapped 18-year-old Susan Bellot and 19-year-old Cheryl Daniel, both of whom were found dead in the wilds of Utah. Hauntingly, Bellot went missing the same day Morin's wife went into labor. It speaks to Morin's arrogance that, after killing Daniel, he reintroduced himself to a friend of hers, Sarah Pizan, now Davis, using a different name. Morin had changed his appearance so convincingly that Davis had no clue she had already met him. In the months before authorities found Daniel's body, Davis says Morin repeatedly asked her out, stalked her, and left her disturbing messages around the clock, including horrifying threats and the apparent sounds of people being tortured. "To this day," Davis tells me, "I will never be without a gun. I have a .45 next to me now, another gun in my vehicle, and a rifle by my bed." Next photo, support system. Palm, celebrating her 70th birthday in California in 2021 with her daughter Noelle. If he wasn't assaulting and murdering women, he was recruiting them for other selfish purposes, like a woman in Buffalo, whom he convinced, after only knowing her for 2 months, to liquidate her belongings, buy a van, and join him on a cross-country road trip. The woman's son later wrote an essay recalling how he helped Morin nail carpet to the van's ceiling and walls before the trip. Years later, he realized in horror that he had helped the serial killer soundproof his vehicle. During a 1981 pit stop in Denver, Morin, using the alias Rich Clark, picked up 23-year-old former teacher Sheila Whalen, strangled her to death, checked into a motel, turned on the TV, and deposited her nude body on the bed. Immediately before picking up Whalen, Morin had taken another woman on a date where the two played video games. In the early hours of December 11th, 1981, the same day he kidnapped Palm, Morin made a mistake. While pulling a gun on 21-year-old Carrie Marie Scott in the parking lot of Maggie's, an eatery in San Antonio, Scott's friend suddenly appeared, surprising Morin, who shot both women, Scott fatally. A bystander took down Morin's license plate number, and hours later the police tracked him to a seedy motel. When Morin left his room, where he was keeping a woman named Pamela Jackson hostage, to grab a Coke from a vending machine, he spotted police in the parking lot. He returned to his room, snaked his 5'8" frame out a tiny bathroom window, and escaped before the motel was swarmed by the SWAT team. Though they missed Morin, police were able to free Jackson. Stunningly, Morin had slipped away from authorities even more narrowly before. Earlier that year, he had been arrested and brought into police custody twice under aliases, in Pleasanton, California, for false imprisonment and brandishing a weapon, and in Buffalo for loitering with the purpose of engaging in a deviant sexual act. In Pleasanton, Morin made bail and disappeared before authorities could determine his true identity. In Buffalo, he was fingerprinted and spent the night in a cell, but once the alias he was using had only a single minor arrest on record, authorities did not rush fingerprint analysis and let Morin out with a trial date before getting the results. "They had him in their custody, and they let him go," says Reed, the former Bexar County DA. "They could have saved several lives of young innocent women, and that didn't happen." Revelations. Palm finally caught up with the news of the day several hours into the abduction when Morin pulled into a 7-Eleven and told her to go inside and get him a newspaper, cigarettes, and beer. Palm entered the empty, fluorescent-lit store. She got a case of Budweiser from the cooler and a pack of cigarettes, then found the San Antonio News. The front-page headline made clear that her captor was far more dangerous than she let herself believe. "Accused killer of 30 guns down 2 in San Antonio. I freaked out when I saw the headline," Palm tells me. She set the items down and wrestled with whether she should alert the cashier. "I was the only one in there with this girl, and I did not turn him in. He was sitting there watching me, and I knew if I did something, I might die, and she might die." There was a phone booth outside the 7-Eleven. Morin forced Palm into it, pressed his gun into her side, and instructed her to call her husband and tell him everything was fine. Morin listened as Palm told Bart that she decided to finish her holiday shopping that evening. She asked Bart to feed their children, give them baths, and put them to sleep. She had never once in their marriage asked him to handle the kids' evening rituals, but Bart chalked it up to pre-Christmas jitters. It was only after watching the 10 p.m. news, which was devoted to Morin's San Antonio rampage, that Bart became worried. His wife still wasn't home. He called the cops. Hours later, after he'd listened to Ride Like the Wind in the Suburban a few times, Morin became polite for an armed captor. He was now apologizing for cursing in front of her and volunteering details about his personal life. He told Palm that he hated himself and that he was a fraud, that he had been married and had a son that he loved but abandoned. Before that, the emotion Morin projected most was hatred, a hatred for himself and others so deep, Morin claimed, that no God could ever rid him of it. "All of a sudden, he's telling me how much he loves his son," says Palm. Palm had been trying to tell Morin for hours that everyone is worthy of forgiveness, but he hadn't bought it. She turned to him and posed a question. "If your son committed the kind of crimes you did, do you think you could forgive him?" Morin seemed to get it. "Lady, you've been preaching to me all day long, and I now understand what you're saying," he said. Palm felt calmed by the conversation and even grew peaceful enough to fall asleep. She was jolted awake by Morin pulling the car over. He threw his hands up in the air and said, I'm sorry, Lord, for everything I've done. Please forgive me. I want to go to heaven. Afterward, at a rest stop, he opened his revolver, poured the bullets into Palm's purse, and told her, I'll never kill again. To be clear, they were not his only bullets. When police arrested him hours later, he had 11 backups in his pocket, as well as a bag of speed and sedatives. Palm had spoken throughout the day about her own religious beliefs, which she had kept secret from friends. Strangely, I found myself saying to him, this guy that kidnapped me and I can't get away from yet. Things I never said to anyone, she says. If I had said it to people I knew, they would think I was crazy. It was really strange being in that car. I felt compassion for him, but he was still kidnapping me. Palm had told Morin that ministers preached God's love to inmates who'd done the same things he had and helped free them of their hatred. She also told Morin about Copeland, the televangelist, who was based in Fort Worth. Morin decided to go there, and in a grand gesture lay down his gun on Copeland's desk. Palm had no idea that there was a bus station in Kerrville, a small city 65 miles north of San Antonio. This was long before the internet, but says that instinct guided her there. She announced the plan to Morin, and after he asked her for money, withdrew $300 from an ATM for him. They drove north, passing a steakhouse. Under different circumstances, Morin told her, he would be taking her there on a date. At the station, they discovered that Morin could get to Fort Worth on the next bus, with a stopover in Austin. Palm bought Morin a ticket so he could find the televangelist. You don't want to come with me? He asked. I have two kids at home, she reminded him. You've got to get on that bus. God is with you. After asking permission, Morin hugged Palm and kissed her on the cheek. She gave him her notebook of scriptures and told him to use them instead of his weapons. He reached into a pocket, produced an earring with a cross and a green stone, and gave it to her. When Morin walked away, Palm got into the driver's seat of the Suburban and immediately locked the doors. As the bus pulled away, Morin waved from a window with a big smile, like a kid on his way to summer camp. When Palm pulled out of the parking lot, she burst into tears. Later, she says, she was told by police that Morin had given similar earrings to women he'd murdered. Driving home, Palm was overwhelmed by terror and relief, but strangely, she felt a bit of hopefulness, too. I felt like something wonderful happened to him, she insists. I saw the change. As she turned onto her street, police responding to Bart's call pulled in behind her. Seeing Palm pull into the driveway, seemingly fine, Bart was initially furious with his wife for causing unwarranted worry. He confronted her. Where the hell have you been? I've been thinking you've been with this rapist. I have been with him, Palm said. She opened her purse to show him, and the officers now huddling with them, Morin's bullets. The police were shocked to see she had survived the encounter, apparently unscathed. They told her and Bart how lucky they were. I need a drink, Palm announced. Somebody get her a drink, demanded an officer. Bart made Palm a martini. Then the couple loaded into the back seat of the squad car, Palm with glass in hand, to go to the police station. While there, the reality of what Palm had encountered set in. She was shown photos of what looked to be 15 or 20 different men. They were all Morin. I felt like somebody hit me with a baseball bat, she says. I couldn't comprehend it. Then the police showed her crime scene photos that revealed what Morin was capable of. Pictures of his victims who had been bound, sexually assaulted, and murdered. I was so disgusted and sickened, she says. I had never heard of a mass murderer. I didn't realize the magnitude of how lucky I was to get away from this man. She also felt duped. There was no way that a man who tortured women for apparent sport had seen God in her car. I thought, he's been conning me all day, she says. That was a sickening feeling. Even in the face of all the horrible stuff I saw, and learning this is the most diabolical con man out there, I wanted to believe what happened was real. Palm was terrified that, if Morin found out she had given the police information about his whereabouts, he'd return to San Antonio and do to her family what he'd done to so many others. So she told the officers that she had left Morin at the Kmart. They must have known she was lying. There was no way that the criminal who had outwitted police for years would have burned 8 hours while they were hunting him, only to go back to the place he started. But they drove Palm and Bart back home to recover. Once inside her front door, Palm broke down and told Bart everything. She knew where Morin was. His bus would be in Austin for less than an hour before it left for Fort Worth at 3:30 a.m. It was now roughly 2:45. Bart insisted they call the cops. If he kills anybody else, and you had the opportunity to stop him and didn't, it's going to be on your conscience. He phoned the San Antonio police and explained why Palm had lied. Then he called the local FBI office. The agent Bart spoke to appreciated the information, but was highly skeptical that Morin would actually be in the Austin bus station. We've been after this guy for years, Bart recalls the agent saying. He doesn't do anything stupid. He won't be there. Nevertheless, Bart says, the agent dispatched police to the bus station, where they surrounded the building. A plainclothes policewoman entered the terminal, where she was shocked to find Morin calmly waiting for his bus and reading Palm's book of scriptures. Until that day, Morin had told anyone who would listen that he'd never go back to prison after the horrific experiences he had in institutions in his youth. But when the officer approached Morin and identified herself, his revolver was still empty, and he did not resist arrest. The press had a field day reporting the unbelievable story of the woman who peacefully defused the serial killer who'd evaded authorities for so long. That's the most fantastic pinch I've heard about in the last 5 years, a sex crimes officer told reporters. This was a highly religious woman, San Antonio Detective Abel Juarez marveled to the San Francisco Sunday Examiner and Chronicle. She prayed a lot and softened him up. Through her religion, she convinced him to release her, and after listening to her preaching, he decided to empty his gun. Months after Morin's peaceful arrest, Palm began to truly believe that he had seen God that day and decided to change. Morin's surviving victims and their families and Texas prosecutors would be harder to convince. Dead Man Walking. Morin's first capital murder trial for the killing of Carrie Marie Scott in Maggie's parking lot was fast-tracked the following year. By April 1982, just 4 months after Scott's murder and Palm's kidnapping, the serial killer stood in a Beaumont, Texas courtroom. Reed, the district attorney, was reading the indictment when Morin jumped up. In a scene that would make a Perry Mason fan's heart leap, the papers reported, and announced, before the jury and before God, I plead guilty. He was asked whether he understood that the charge would result in either life in prison or the death sentence, with no chance to negotiate. The only plea bargaining I've done, Your Honor, is with my Lord, Morin replied. During the sentencing arguments, Reed says, Morin's whole defense was that he had found Jesus. He quoted scripture while addressing the jury from behind a bulletproof barrier. Any man that be in Christ is a new creature, and old things are passed away, and brought his own Bible into the courtroom. One of his lawyers acknowledged that Morin had been the scum of the earth, and a murderer kidnapper, rapist, and thief, but claimed he had undergone a transformation and is born again. Palm was called as a defense witness to testify about his conversion. Morin's lawyer argued that his client's conversion could be educational to others. After hearing from some of Morin's survivors, the jury deliberated for just over 2 hours, and the defendant received the death penalty. "We could accept that he was a born-again Christian," the jury foreman said afterward, "but we didn't go along with it to the point of where we felt he wouldn't kill again." At that first trial, Morin had, in a narcissistic flourish, asked to act as his own co-counsel, hoping to represent himself as Bundy had. The judge denied the request, but Morin was allowed to question potential jury members for his next trial in Corpus Christi, Texas, for the strangulation of 21-year-old Jana Bruce. One question he posed was, "Do you believe that a person, despite what an individual's past has been, no matter how bad, can be sincere in changing?" Morin was again found guilty and sentenced to death. In April 1982, less than 2 weeks after he was initially sentenced to death, Morin wrote the judge in his first murder trial and asked him to set an execution date. "Christians are not afraid to die," he wrote. "I have been prepared to meet my Maker from the time I was blessed enough to meet Mrs. Palm." Later, Bart finally accepted that Morin had changed. "Every police officer I talked to said he was a consummate con man. So who's to say he wasn't conning us?" says Bart, noting that posing as a born-again Christian to lighten his sentence would have been the ultimate con. "But when he refused to appeal, that's when I believed." In 1984, Morin was extradited to Golden, Colorado, where he stood trial for the 1981 murder of Sheila Whalen. Though Morin already faced 2 death sentences, the former Jefferson County Deputy District Attorney Carrie Unkelbach says that Morin was such a clear threat as a repeat murderer-rapist, the state of Colorado decided to prosecute him in the event his sentences in Texas were overturned. Death penalty cases are a lot of work, a lot of emotion, a lot of cost, says Unkelbach. "But we were confident we'd done the right thing. We were sure he was going to kill again." During Morin's trials, she notes, one judge was so wary of the accused that he kept a loaded .357 Magnum on his bench. Despite what Morin repeatedly said about being saved, a sheriff's deputy found that he had a pair of shoes, hiding $50, razor blades, a list of names and addresses, and a Texas driver's license. Morin claimed he needed the items for protection. In his letters to Palm after the contraband was reported, Morin vaguely referred to a lapse in faith that had occurred while he was in Colorado. Unkelbach says that she and others tried to negotiate with Morin during the sentencing in Colorado in the hopes of determining his involvement in dozens of other murders. Despite his claim that he was a God-fearing individual, he refused to work with prosecutors. There was not much of a negotiation upside for him. He had already been served 2 death sentences. "We really wanted to clear up those cases," says Unkelbach, "but they were never connected to him because he wouldn't talk." In Golden, Morin was again found guilty and given his 3rd death sentence. By now, Palm was one of Morin's primary lifelines outside of prison. When he moved into the Texas penitentiary, the family's phone would ring with a collect call once or twice a week. Whenever Bart would pick up, he'd roll his eyes and accept the charges, his rationale being, "He's on death row. What am I going to do?" Morin tried to chat Bart up like a long-lost buddy. "How are you doing? How's everything?" But Bart's answer was always the same. "I'm fine, Stephen. Here's Margie." Palm and Morin talked about Morin's life, but their conversations were largely spiritual. One day he asked her, "Do you think I'm going to die?" "I hope you don't die," she told him. "I hope you live and can help other people the way God has helped you. But at the same time, if you do die, I believe you are going to be with the Lord." Despite believing that Morin could be forgiven, Palm never thought he deserved anything less than life in prison. "It's like a wild animal," she says. "Try to tame a wild animal, and they might be sweet for a while. Then they bite your head off." He lived so long in that dark place. I imagine that the thoughts he lived with for so many years would come back. The letters that Morin wrote to Palm from various cells in Texas and Colorado are a wild ride into the consciousness, delusions, and contradictory sentiments of a violent sociopath who insisted that he had reformed. Oddly, he seemed to feel guiltier about disrupting Bart's life than about the women he murdered. Morin wrote in one early letter, "If Bart doesn't feel too kind towards me, I can understand. It would be hard for any man to have the privacy of his family invaded." Incredibly, Morin seemed to consider himself to be a threat to Bart and Palm's marriage. Writing to Bart, "I sincerely hope and pray I have not come between you and Margie, nor will I ever due to my encounter with your wife." Writing on Jefferson County Detention Facility stationery, Morin later attempted to turn Bart onto religion, even using real estate terms that might appeal to the commercial developer. "Why not invest your life and heart into the bridge of eternal life?" In one letter, Morin reflected on his marital history with appalling delusion. "I don't feel bitter towards any of my wives, as I'm sure I was a big part of things going bad." In another, he talked about being converted, claiming that he could have easily evaded authorities after Palm dropped him off at the Kerrville bus station. "Instead, I sat in the bus station for over 3 hours with a pocket full of bullets and an empty gun, awaiting whatever fate our Lord had in mind for me," he wrote. "I sat there reading Margie's scriptures with a warmth inside of me beyond words." But every time Morin appeared to approach accountability, he veered off course. In the same letter, he says, "Furthermore, just for the record, I have not committed a quarter of the crimes which I am being accused of." In 1984, Morin floated the idea of trying to sell the book and movie rights to his life story. He fantasized that the project would not be based on my crimes, but what contributes on all levels to an innocent child going from parent, school, etc., to death row. He went so far as to divide the hypothetical profits, allotting 20% for himself, 10% for Kenneth Copeland Ministries, and 5% to my son's trust fund for his education, not streetwise. He claimed, "I don't want anything other than to be able to turn a tragic ending into something good." Morin often maintained that he had no qualms about being executed, and on March 13, 1985, he made good on that claim. On his way to the death chamber, the 34-year-old jokingly asked if anyone wanted to go fishing instead. Once inside, he was strapped to a gurney and stayed calm while technicians struggled for at least 40 minutes to successfully insert a needle, into one of his veins, which were damaged from drug use. It was finally inserted at 12:44 a.m., along with a cocktail of sodium thiopental, potassium chloride, and Pavilion. Morin's final words were, "Lord Jesus, I commit my soul to you. I praise you and I thank you." Texas's Attorney General at the time, Jim Maddox, called Morin's execution the least violent one he had witnessed. It was like a person being put to sleep in an operation. "Most people I speak to reject the idea that Morin was actually born again. My grandfather was a minister, and I believe in God like there's no other way, says Sarah Davis, the woman whom Morin stalked and terrorized in 1980. But I don't know that this man could have ever been saved. The woman who was raped and tortured by Morin when she was 14 doesn't believe it either. She thinks that the Christian Morin was just another alias that Morin used, like Robert Generoso or Robert Andrew Ireland. He was just reaching out for an excuse to get off the death penalty, she says. Though she was a prosecuting witness in Morin's first murder trial and still bears the emotional scars of Morin's torture, she admits that she cried when she realized Morin would be put to death. Isn't that stupid, she tells me? Just the fact that I knew I killed somebody. When I protest that she didn't kill anyone, she replies, it sure felt like I did. After her traumatic encounter with Morin, the woman actually sees horror movies like Saw, about a murderer who subjects victims to physical and psychological torture, as inspirational. I like to see how people make it through, she says. Even 5 decades later. Palm was initially reluctant to discuss her kidnapping because it exposed the depth of her faith. People are going to think I'm a Christian nut, and I've lost my mind, she remembers thinking. She agreed to a few local interviews, but insisted that she be identified by her maiden name, or if she appeared on screen, that she appear in shadow. She turned down Good Morning America and Today. Later, Palm did share her story with churches and religious organizations, but she'd often have a limited amount of time to describe an event that she hadn't fully plumbed, so she told abbreviated versions in what she calls Christianese, the power of God's love being the star of the story. Like the other Morin survivors I spoke to, Palm never tried therapy, which wasn't as widely accepted as it is now. It was only when Palm began writing about the experience, with the help of Noel, about 10 years ago, that she began processing what happened to her on a deeper level. Noel has since become a marriage and family therapist, specializing in trauma, and she emits empathy like an essential oil diffuser. She coaxed her mother into confronting a more complicated reality about what she endured. I do not and could not have answers, Palm says, but I have a story. By no means does Palm think she had some secret formula that the other victims did not. She understands that she encountered Morin at the end of a crime spree when he was feeling cornered. And, perhaps because of that, was more receptive to her. It was an anomalous moment, she tells me, speaking from an antique bench in her living room, light streaming onto her from the French patio doors and a skylight above. Had he kidnapped her months before, who knows if she would have survived? I've grown a lot in the past few years and learned about trauma and how to talk about these things, says Palm. She wishes that she'd had the vocabulary and understanding to hold more and more accountable for his crimes, to urge him to speak to victims' families and cooperate with authorities questioning about the other murders he was suspected of committing. I didn't have that language at age 30, but if he were still alive, that's what I wish I could do. In some ways, the Palms resumed their life post-kidnapping with remarkable normality. Amazingly, they kept the Suburban. I have no idea why we didn't get rid of that thing, Palm says, which had been the scene of the crime. I think it was an absolute fluke that will never happen again, Bart tells me in the living room, as the family's calico cats, Tiki and Lala, in other words, Tequila, survey the premises. Just wrong place, wrong time. After spending days with Palm in San Antonio, I understand how Morin could have been softened and enchanted by her kindness. By the end of a long weekend, she's invited me to join the family Sunday night dinner on the lawn of the local country club with her kids and grandkids. When Palm tells me how happy she is that we met, her words are so sincere, I feel as though I'd be welcomed back for Thanksgiving. The imprints of the grislier side of her kidnapping are still evident in her everyday life, however. She drives a car in attention-grabbing fire engine red, and she only parks in well-lit spots near entrances. She rarely goes to big stores unless she has a companion with her. The Christmas season, and Christmas carols in particular, much like Ride Like the Wind, are activating, sending her down a terrifying memory spiral. She freaks out, understandably, if she does not hear back from her grown children in a timely manner. Not long ago, Palm was unnerved by a scene in Mindhunter, the Netflix series inspired by pioneering FBI profiler John E. Douglas and his studies of serial killers. At the end of season one, the Douglas proxy, Jonathan Groff, sits opposite shackled murderer Ed Kemper, Cameron Britton. Groff's character has come to consider Kemper a work friend. But during the scene, Kemper slowly peels back the friendly facade to reveal that he is still very much a murderer and threat, even to Groff's character, who runs from the room, realizing that he's fallen for the killer's manipulations. When Palm and Noel watched the scene, they had to take breaks to shut off the TV and turn on lights. Morin asked Palm to attend his 1985 execution, but she decided it was more important to be with her husband that day. She visited the killer on death row at the infamous LS-1 unit near Huntsville, Texas, the day before, though. The trip was long. Palm flew to Houston and buckled in for a road trip to the prison alongside a priest who waited in the prison parking lot. The red brick building was ominous, with spiraled razor wire coils atop tall fencing, high voltage signs, and guard towers. But inside, after passing through a security checkpoint and a heavy metal door, Palm says the warden gave her a hug and greeted her warmly. At the time, she recalls, there were open windows, allowing in a pleasant breeze and the scents from a vegetable garden. She was taken to a room. Soon, Morin was led in and sat behind a glass partition. He had his Bible, a can of Sprite, and a huge smile on his face. "He was happy," Palm tells me. He said, "I'm ready to die. I feel good. I'm going to be with the Lord." I have a hard time believing Morin could really be happy hours before his execution, until Palm shows me Polaroids the warden took that day. Morin's grinning like a high school senior on the last day of school. During that final visit, Palm showed her former captor photos of her young children. The mood grew serious when the two turned to the Bible. "We took hands and prayed," says Palm, adding that Morin cried about the crimes he committed. He said, "I'm sorry for what my life has been. I wish I'd done something with myself." Morin also told her, "I'm sorry for kidnapping you, but not really. I'm glad we met, because my life changed. I'm not the same person I was before. I've got so many friends now. I've got all these people that really love me." After telling me about this final meeting, Palm sits with me and Noelle at her kitchen counter, combing through Morin's letters. One envelope bears the image of a unicorn and a sticker reading, "Sing a New Song to the Lord." Sent in September 1982, the letter says in part, "You once said you would never give up on me. I want to thank you for standing by your word." In another letter, Morin expressed surprising affection, writing, "I do love you." Even after everything I've heard, I am shocked to see that. I look up at Palm, expecting to see my surprise mirrored back. But she's smiling. I ask her what she feels when she reads those words now, It's touching, she says. The fact that he went from screaming at me to saying that is pretty incredible. Earlier, I'd asked Noelle what she thinks of her mother's reconciliation of Morin the serial killer and Morin the saved man. She curls her feet up underneath her and collects her thoughts before answering. Like many daughters, Noelle is the preeminent expert in her mother's emotional experience. Having grown up with this kidnapping story, she's had decades to metabolize it and contemplate various possibilities. That Morin was genuinely saved, that he was a narcissistic sociopath, or something in between. Maybe Morin stopped delaying his execution because he was ready to accept punishment. Or maybe he knew that being executed would spare him years of misery behind bars that mirrored his teen days in Florida State Prison. Noelle has considered all the alternatives and admits, I am of the opinion that I have no clue. But she does know her mom. I think every survivor has to find a story that gives them peace, she says. It's going to be different for every survivor. For some survivors, it's like, he's going to rot in hell, and that gives them peace. For Mom, I think the story that helps her survive is that he was a changed man. She references the way Palm isolated Morin's evil impulses from Morin himself during the car exorcism and in the years since. Separating the person from the problem has been such a survival tool for her, she says. It's what's helped her that day, and it's what helped keep her from having nightmares.
Thank you.
Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis. Audra McDonald, Broadway's Tony favorite, holds forth on her loves and her loathings. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Being at home on a Sunday night with my husband, Will, and all of our children, eating chicken tikka masala and naan from our favorite restaurant. What is your greatest fear? Balloons. I have a big phobia of balloons. Big. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? If hoarding and procrastination were Olympic sports, I'd have at least 70 gold medals. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Judy Garland, but not for the reason you think. I identify with the insecurity she had as a performer. She once said something like, "I always worry that this is the time they'll figure out that I don't know what I'm doing up there." I feel that deep, deep, deep in my bones. What is your greatest extravagance? As a New Yorker and a terrible cook, I order takeout much more than I should. What is your favorite journey? Journeying home to my family, which I'm doing right now. On what occasion do you lie? When they ask your weight for the teeny tiny puddle jumper planes, I have lied every time, every single time. What do you dislike most about your appearance? Not going to answer that. My New Year's resolution this year is less self-loathing, more self-loving. What is your greatest regret? That I didn't take time to go out to breakfast with my dad on what would turn out to be the last time I ever saw him alive. What or who is the greatest love of your life? Will and my daughters. When and where were you happiest? In the hospital, giving birth to my second daughter, with my first daughter right there in the room as it was happening. I don't remember any pain. I just remember feeling more alive and full of fierce mama bear love than at any other point in my life. What are your favorite names? Zoe and Sally. Which living person do you most admire? Meghan Markle. I don't know how she continues to walk through this world with the grace, strength, and purpose that she does, given the unbearable amount of vitriol and hate she has been subjected to, but she does. I wish she didn't have to. Which talent would you most like to have? To be able to speak 6 or 7 languages fluently. What is your current state of mind? Anxious. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? Be less anxious. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? A body of water. I'm all emotion, so a body of water feels like the right expression of that. Probably a sea or an ocean, definitely salt water. What is your most treasured possession? Little pieces of an old teddy bear that I got when I was about 7 years old. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Living a life filled with hate. Who are your heroes in real life? Black women. What is it that you most dislike? Cruelty and beats. I despise both. How would you like to die? In my bed at home at a ripe old age, with the knowledge that my children and grandchildren, if I have any, are thriving, happy, and provided for. What is your most marked characteristic? Very emotional, with very big hair. What is your motto? Dream big, love bigger, eat a cookie. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Audra McDonald.
Thank you.
This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.